Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Houston.
So later this episode, we'll be hearing from DC Thompson's consumer magazines publisher, Sally Hampton. We caught up with her at MagFest about the huge variety of magazines she publishes, what her growth strategy is for some of the more niche titles. I mean, she's got some really niche titles, and how optimistic she is for the future of magazine media.
Don't forget, though, that you can also listen to our episode of the Media Voices Conversation, sponsored by Flume. Me, Fergus Gregory, and Roland Monks from Flume, we take a sort of in-depth, hour-long look at the future of advertising to see whether it's more hassle than it's worth for publishers. As ever, though, we are going to start with our news roundup. So, you know, what has happened this week apart from all the most depressing news in the world?
Well, and among all the most depressing news in the world, particularly on Capitol Hill, I just saw this live tweeting thing from BuzzFeed News, a reporter called Paul McLeod. And you know, forget all forget the ethics, the politics, the moral morass for a second, because that is depressing. But this guy's using Twitter to report live on this judiciary hearing in the States. And it's just incredible, absolutely incredible. He's got this thread going, maybe 50, 60 tweets over 5 hours. And the sort of high point of this was when this Flake guy, whatever his name is, Senator Flake, changed his position. And the drama that this reporter managed to build up in this, it was unreal. It was like, well, it was like a well-made drama.
Yeah, it has been really, really depressing to watch all that, you know, break and kind of the story unfold. But at the same time, you do get the impression that it's almost brought out the best in the journalism industry, you know, in the kind of, and even in the sort of faux outrage industry, which you see on late night TV. You know, some of that has been the best it's been for, you know, for ages as a result.
Did you see the video of the two ladies having a go at this guy Flake in the elevator?
I did, and you're actually the third or fourth person to ask me if I'd seen it. It's real,
it's,
you know,
amazing.
Water cooler moment.
Whether it actually makes any difference or not, at least the reporters were there and they caught it and they put it out. CNN put it out. Failing CNN or whatever the hell the yellow man baby calls it.
But it's not just, I guess, the population of Earth who's had a really bad week, because, you know, whether you think that corporations are people too, Facebook itself had a really bad week as well. Esther, what happened here?
Well, late Friday, they had a big security meltdown. I think they said it was 50 to 90 million accounts have been affected. But we don't know that much yet about it. So I think we'll save, kind of dive into it for next week, just because it's obviously all sort of breaking over the weekend. So who knows?
Yeah.
You've got to reckon, though, when The Verge is running on an article that says it's time to leave the world's biggest social network and starts advising people how to delete Facebook, you know they've got some issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's bigger than originally thought, right? Because it's not just Facebook logins that got leaked. It was everything you've ever logged into using Facebook.
Well, they also had issues this week because it turns out that they're actually selling people's phone numbers for advertising. Shock, horror.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? And the founders of Instagram kind of left after, by the sounds of it, clashing with Zuckerberg and disagreeing over the future of all these millions of people they have on their site. So
not just those guys either. Yeah. You see, the founder of WhatsApp as well has, I mean, he's been making noise about this for quite a while, but he basically said, you know, he didn't like this kind of industrial process which WhatsApp had been turned into as a result of this kind of sale to Facebook.
I hope it makes Facebook take a right good look at itself in the mirror. Fix some of these problems.
It's going to need to take a long, hard bath with itself and decide what actually matters to its users. The problem is, what matters to its users isn't necessarily what's good for publishers, as we've seen. You know, when they reduced the amount of news content that appeared in the newsfeed from 5% to 4%, that was nothing. Users barely noticed the difference. Publishers got absolutely hammered by that algorithm change.
The moral of the story is build your business on your own frigging domain.
God, we've really streamlined the process of getting to that point. Hey, speaking of, The Independent is putting up a partial paywall. So it's offering readers exclusive content from £55 a year.
So let me split my head schizophrenically in two here. I think the intention here is excellent. You know, I think The Independent, they've done some great stuff and they're not scared of taking a decision or two. I think the place that they're going to struggle is they don't have the brand loyalty maybe that The Telegraph has, especially digitally. You know, The Telegraph, God love them, probably doesn't actually, but they've had people reading that thing since they were running around in their short pants knocking a wheel up a cobbled street with a stick or whatever.
They've got, what is this Dickensian like picture of past Telegraph readers? I love the idea that, you know, when you get a press pack about a newspaper and you go like, oh, you know, we're the Guardian reach A1 audiences, and then the Telegraph's one is, we reach mainly Victorian paupers, landowners from the mid-1800s.
But they've just got a historic, they've got a brand there that's got long, long loyalty. The indie doesn't have that, and I wonder... In a weird kind of sense, the Independent's going to have better content than the Telegraph to be able to charge people. That's my point.
Well, the deal itself, so if you sign up to this subscription deal, you get, they've said, exclusive editorial content, an ad-free website. Well, that might be appealing. You get a better app experience. They said exclusive email bulletins, free tickets to events, and a closer interaction with journalists. It's called the Press Gazette. And they've also said that subscribers will be able to shape coverage by suggesting subjects to be covered in editorials. So it's just a bit like, is that enough to convince them? I mean, to be fair, it's not a lot of money they're asking. I think if you pay monthly, it's $5.99 a month.
I think the point is really going to come down to what's the nitty-gritty of this. What's these newsletters going to be about? What additional exclusive content? What are these free tickets? You know, if a free ticket's going to be worth more than $5.99, then yeah, I'm in.
But free tickets to what? Because this kind of thing works pretty well for niche publications where you can offer exclusive bulletins, but you can't get kind of free elsewhere. I suppose you could argue that's the same for any newspaper brand. But
I think it's so. There's another story that we've flagged up this week about the Independent. It's part of a study that the Neiman lad did. Looking at the Independent's print readership when they went all digital, and the point was the print readership didn't migrate, and that just talks again to that issue of loyalty.
Does it speak to loyalty? I don't know that there's a single print brand out there, maybe the FT, maybe some of those kind of very in-depth business titles that would have success, you know, convincing its readers to go from print to digital. So this fascinating study. Really, really like it. Need to look at the methodology. But I'm not sure it says quite as much as people are making of this. I don't think that there's necessarily... Well, A, it's an apples to oranges comparison. Print being a different product, yeah, you can actually spend time with it in a very different way than you do with a digital product. So I'm not sure that this is necessarily a loyalty thing.
Well, yeah, but look... Okay, I get what you're saying from an academic point of view. But from a publisher's brand revenue point of view, it's absolutely about loyalty. If I've got this bunch of customers over here giving me 50 pence a day and all of a sudden they're gone, then if I haven't got the loyalty to take them to me with digital, I'm starting from square one.
Yeah, but what happened when they went digital only? What happened to their business?
Their numbers went up.
They became profitable.
But that's because of cost cutting.
Well, exactly.
Oh, now we're back at that, bollocks. But like, you can't cut your way to success.
You can to sustainability, and like I say, it's a terrifying study. If you actually look at, you know, if you look at the results that they've surfaced here. So, reading from the Nyman Lab roundup of this says Thurman and Fletcher calculate that in the 12 months before and after stopping print, the total time spent consuming the Independent dropped from 5.548 billion minutes to 1.056 billion minutes. But this, again, that's just, it's an apples to oranges comparison because you don't necessarily spend the same time you do with digital products. I mean, look at this. The amount of time I technically spend with podcasts far outstrips the amount of time I spend on most news websites just because I listen to 3-hour podcasts. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not more loyal to those ones that, you know, I do pay to subscribe to. It just means that the actual time I spend with them is being spent in a different way.
Okay, we'll end up with an argument about loyalty and what it actually means. But yeah. What you're really talking about is engagement, yeah. Not loyalty.
Okay, fair enough.
I did love the aside in this article, though, that was about how journalists and people in the media have a really hard time understanding the difference between print and digital consumption, because we as journalists consume a ton of digital news day and night, and we basically need to remember that actually we're the outliers, and that that's not how most people interact with news. It actually says a reporter getting a dozen morning newsletters, listening to a news podcast on the morning commute, Chris, getting news alerts on their phone and monitoring Twitter for the latest all days is engaging in very extreme behaviour.
So basically, they're basically saying we're not normal.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, that's why we have such an inflated opinion of Twitter as well, because it is the journalist platform. I think it was something ridiculous, like a third of all verified users were journalists. Moving on then, Walt Disney and 21st Century Fox are selling their shares in Sky to Comcast, putting on course to take full control. So this follows news last weekend that Comcast had effectively gazumped Fox for control of Sky, which has been this long-running, ongoing saga about who actually gets to take control of one of the UK's largest internet providers and, you know, content producers. And ultimately, it all went down to kind of affinity between these brands, and Comcast really went over and above.
This just maybe goes back to that survey of people thinking there's too much US content in our media, but I don't think it's going to make that much difference. And, you know, at the end of the day, Rupert Murdoch's been in charge forever, so...
Yeah, he's been made. He's been made. He's even richer now. So all Sky shareholders are much, much richer as a result of this. The chart was ridiculous. So Disney and Fox are going to sell their 39% stake to give Comcast full control, and that deal alone was worth about $11.6 billion. And Disney are basically saying they're going to plow all that money back into content production, because that ultimately is the name of the game. That is partly why Comcast bought Sky in the first place, because it gives them access to, you know, a suite of content. It also crucially gives them access to infrastructure in OTT services across Europe. And this works for Sky as well, because it gives them access to Comcast's content and its universal content as well.
So is this all a big sort of play to compete with Netflix and Amazon and whatever?
Ultimately, pretty much, yeah. There's obviously a lot of different considerations. You know, Comcast had much more in common with Sky than 21st Century Fox, because it is also a kind of provider of, you know, internet infrastructure. But yeah, ultimately, it seems like they know which side they're ready to put to. They know that everyone's going to be breaking out and doing these individual, you know, OTT content services. And this really seems to be an act of consolidation to give them the best possible library that they can.
And will it beat Netflix?
Nope.
Hey, Media Voices has spoken.
So, despite great traffic, Apple is making publishers a negligible amount of money, according to a candid reveal by Slate this week.
Yeah, so I think this is another shocking revelation that posting your content to other people's ecosystems doesn't make you as much money as keeping it on your own.
Mm.
And I think we've been aware of this about Apple News for a while, but nobody's ever wanted to reveal numbers, and Apple certainly doesn't. So basically, Apple doesn't do referral traffic like Facebook. Apple kind of keeps everybody inside its own app and ecosystem inside Apple News. And the issue here is that Apple actually makes it quite difficult for publishers to fill ad inventory inside News. Like, it doesn't support a lot of the common ad systems, again, surprise, surprise. So it's not worth kind of developing and selling ads specifically for Apple News. And their partnership with NBC Universal to sell the ad slots basically isn't proving profitable at all. So Slate did this big reveal where it says it makes the same amount of money from a single article that gets 50,000 page views than it does from the 6 million page views it receives on Apple News in the average month. I mean, that's absolutely insane figures.
That feels like a bizarre allocation of resources. Do you remember, it wasn't even that long ago that people were saying, oh, you know, what Apple's doing is going to be the saviour of journalism, because it's kind of...
I've had a lot of people say it, yeah.
Or were they
actually... It's based on the platform Ponzi scheme that has developed around media.
Mm.
People are just desperate for revenue.
A lot of publishers in the app have seen quite healthy page view growth this year. So you think, oh, if page view is increasing, revenue should as well. And that seems to be the equation that isn't quite adding up at the moment.
When is the world going to realise that a page view is not the same as a pound?
So this week I spoke to Sally Hampton, who is the consumer magazines publisher at DC Thompson. So I started off by asking her how long she'd been at DC Thompson and what some of the most significant industry changes she's seen in her time working there.
I think over that period, I've seen an increased focus on the business of magazines, certainly in the roles that I perform. And that sits alongside what has traditionally been the focus on creativity. But I would say every member of the team now is focused on the need to make money, whereas when I first started in magazine publishing, it was only the people at the top of publishing companies who were focused on the bottom line, and everyone else just focused on their job, their writing, their designing, whatever. But I would say everyone is focused on the commercial imperatives of the business.
Is that healthy?
Yeah, yeah, I think it is healthy. I think it's really healthy. And actually, I think it unlocks people's creativity. And I think it's really, really healthy to be open and communicative and to know how the levers work and to know who your customers are. Obviously, a magazine journalist or a magazine designer has to be really, really in tune with their readers, with the people who engage with them on social media, but they also need to know that our commercial partners, what they're trying to achieve as well, so that we can have informed adult conversations about what is acceptable, what is ethical, what is beneficial for everyone involved. So yeah, I think it is healthy.
Have you seen any occasions where maybe the commercial focus hampers that creativity a little bit?
Oh, that's quite a difficult question. Not because it's tricky, just because I can't think of one. I guess we have an ongoing discussion, particularly with our ad sales colleagues or perhaps events colleagues, about who is appropriate to partner with. It's perhaps more of an issue for my colleagues who work in children's publications than it is for me. But I've never reached a point where I've thought, oh my God, we've gone down the wrong road here and this isn't right for our readership. We've generally had the conversation beforehand and reached a point where we think, yeah, everyone is benefiting. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion in the industry at the minute around about what's appropriate in terms of bloggers and Instagram influencers and being open about advertising and when they're paid to run content, and I think it, in some ways it's unfair to focus on them because that's a conversation we need to have continually within magazines and newspapers and TV and radio and all the rest of it as well, because there are long running relationships that our publications have with commercial partners, and that's okay, but we should be open with our readers and our consumers about that.
And you deal with, I was trying to look it up online, but you deal with a lot of titles. Can you kind of give us an idea of some of the range and topics?
Yeah, so the title that I've had the longest association with is My Weekly, which is a women's weekly, you won't be surprised to hear, title, although you would be surprised how often I'm asked that question. Our readership is mainly in the 60-plus age range. Our core USP content is fiction and also cookery, and our biggest investment is on original recipe content because that's really important to the readership. I also am publisher of a group of Scottish regional titles. The Scots Magazine is the biggest amongst those, and it's one of the oldest magazines. We think it possibly is the oldest magazine still in publication. It's nearly 300 years old.
It's almost as old as paper, isn't it?
Almost as long as I've been in journalism. So, yeah, and it's a lifestyle and culture magazine celebrating Scotland. We also have Number One, which is a women's fashion and lifestyle Scottish magazine. We have some specialist titles within my remit, one of which is focuses on caravans and motorhomes. And I also do quite a lot of work in new product development as well. Obviously, all of these titles also have an online operation, social media, websites in the main. Some of them do events, some of them do other types of spin-off products. The Scots Magazine is really big on books and spin-off, you know, additional special edition magazines, that type of thing.
And what's it like, so day to day, you know, you come to the office, like how do you kind of manage all those different titles? Because they're really different in terms of sort of audience and things like that.
Yeah, they are, and they're different in terms of revenue and all the rest of it. I have fantastic editors who work on each of the titles, and I'm fairly new in the publisher job, and I was previously editor-in-chief of almost as big a range of titles, but I'm still the editor of My Weekly. And that, I didn't realise at the time how difficult it was, but I have much more structure in my life now because those wonderful editors are running the titles, and I can keep my eye on, obviously, on what they are doing creatively, and we have discussions about what works for our readership, but also really keep my eye on the financials and the bottom line and the opportunity for the titles and pick out those little individual things that might be different and not try to roll out one size fits all business models, because they are so diverse, it's never going to work. And try to spot any areas of concern or any opportunities quickly when the numbers just start to turn, so that we can work together to either turn things around or to take advantage of those opportunities. But very much the key, I think, certainly in the role that I'm in with such a diverse range of titles, is bearing in mind that they do have to be treated differently.
Are there things that work across all of them? Do you sort of think, oh, actually, that might work really well for another title?
Occasionally, yes. And we learn from other brands, both outside our company and also within as well. So I have a really close relationship with all the other editors in the group and with certainly with my peers within PPA. I learn so much from them as well. But yes, there are some things. You know, we can see, for example, if number one is that my colleagues there have recently been experimenting with a slightly different way of creating their web content, and they've gone from a more kind of informational approach with web posts to picking up on items that are in the news, you know, whether that's what we would consider conventional news or fashion news or lifestyle news or whatever, and putting a number one spin on it so that their content seems very current and relevant. And you can take that kind of learning and say to all the other editors, well, why not try this, but with content that's appropriate to your brand. Yeah. So, you know, for my weekly, that might be with 50-plus health-type stories. What is the My Weekly twist on that, and a relevant story for Scots Magazine, obviously, with the Scots cultural or outdoors news stories. So yeah, there are learnings that you can take and that you can extrapolate across the brands, but you have to always think about what is appropriate for the consumers here.
And you've got some quite niche magazines for Scottish readers. Yep. Given that there's always going to be kind of an upper limit on your readership for that, what's your growth strategy around that?
Diversification is really important, and we've been fairly successful with that with Scots Magazine. We've diversified, as I was saying, into books, which are of interest to our readers. We currently have a book on Great Scottish Journeys, which we've worked with another publisher, with a book publisher on, and we're about to send another one to press on Monroes, which is a climbing activity. So we've been successful with that. We're also diversifying into events. But actually our diversification into other products from a Scots Magazine perspective has also led us to grow our core brand, because we've recently started selling many more copies of Scots Magazine in America. Because,
really?
Yeah, in the US, primarily through Barnes & Noble stores. And that's because Scottish culture is suddenly a really, really buzzy issue in the US. Things like Outlander and other similar.
So these are like Americans that are getting the Scots Magazine?
Yeah. Yeah,
thousands of copies.
That's so bizarre. Yeah.
I mean, America's pretty big in terms of an expansion strategy.
It is pretty big, yes. And I'm not entirely sure at this exact moment what the limits on that are. But, yeah, there's a market we'd like to explore.
And you were saying some of the readership for some of your other magazines was sort of 60-plus. Does that start low and grow old, or is that just kind of the age range it's aimed at?
I think it kind of varies. I mean, My Weekly is 118 years old. It was formed in 1910. Hopefully my maths is correct. So I would say the age range of the readership has grown over that 108 years. But it's been fairly stable, certainly in the time that I've been associated with the brand, which is...
Do you get a kind of young people picking it up?
Well, it depends on your definition of younger people, but we do recruit people. Yes, we do recruit people at the younger end. Mm. And I think that's a challenge, really, for almost any, or certainly for print media brands, is that you have to keep recruiting, and there's nothing wrong with having a readership in any age range, whether that be teens to 90s. But obviously, if you want it to remain stable, then you have to recruit people at the younger end.
What would you say are some of your biggest challenges in terms of some of the day-to-day job you do?
Well, I guess there are the challenges that we always have, which are maintaining readership, maintaining circulation, keeping productive relationships with advertising. And in the more general world, you would have to say that all those people, potential readers, potential consumers, potential advertisers, have every day, every year, more and more places to find their entertainment, find their information, and place their advertising. So it's telling those stories, those true stories, about the relevance of our brands to their needs, you know, making sure that our products are quality, are relevant to their groups of readers, and that the people who need to know about it, and also communicating to commercial partners that we can deliver to them unique readerships or niche customer groups that they want to speak to.
Are you finding with your advertisers that they're kind of happy to go for the niche groups, or do a lot of them still want this sort of huge reach that we've heard quite a bit about at Magfest?
Certainly for the brands that I work with, it's more about underserved audiences and finding specialist consumer groups or hard-to-reach consumer groups. It's not really a numbers game as far as I'm concerned.
And how optimistic are you about the future of magazine brands, and why? I phrase that very carefully this time.
I'm very optimistic about the future of magazine brands. I think we can't be complacent. I don't think we should ever have been complacent, but there have been periods when, you know, when magazines were, to a certain extent, a license to print money. But I'm very optimistic about the future, because there are really, really talented but also very commercially focused people who do work in magazines and who want to work in magazines, and who fully appreciate that it's not a simple business, that we do have to think about what it is that people gain from our brands and how we can deliver that to them, yes, in the best possible printed format, but also in what other formats can we deliver that to them. An event, for example, is very like a magazine. You know, you have different areas and different times when you deliver content in entertaining or informative ways, but you mix that up and you do it in different formats, and you have little franchises and longer features and all the rest of it. So I think we have to work hard, and we have to keep our eye on profitability, and we have to produce quality content. But I am very, very optimistic about magazine brands and the magazine industry.
Are there any opportunities or anything you see as being particularly exciting for the next, I don't know, how many years?
I think potentially the underserved consumer is an area that I'll certainly be thinking about. I do, obviously, as you know, have a history of working with older consumers who have traditionally been slightly ignored and also treated as if they are slightly less relevant. But in today's world, if you're looking to sell things, sometimes an older consumer is a very valuable resource to you. Yes. And I think that's an area where there's room for growth. I think obviously we have an imperative to engage children and young people in reading in any form, and I think magazines and comics have a great role to play in that as well.
I'm sure it's been mentioned that somebody said it's kind of the anti-digital age, like parents want to give their kids printed things.
Yeah, and I think also, as human beings, we need a variety of different stimuli. And I don't have anything against people spending time on their smartphones, their tablets, their computers, their virtual reality headsets. Other than the virtual reality headset, I do all those things myself. But I think there are times when it's interesting to sit down with a paper, magazine, newspaper, book. It's a different experience and it brings different things into your mind. And I think also that our journalists and our creatives can also share interesting content with people online as well, and that we have really something to contribute to the nation's culture and conversation.
The final question we always ask you, what's the last thing you've read or watched or saw that really affected you?
You may or may not know, my company DC Thompson operates out of Dundee. And a little bit like the magazine industry, Dundee has occasionally been treated as a less glamorous contemporary of some other cities around the UK. And Dundee's having its moment in the sun just now. There's been a lot of publicity around about the V&A opening, but there's also a lot going on in the city that's connected with the industry that we work in, like design, the UNESCO City of Design. And when Lonely Planet singled out Dundee as one of the coolest little cities in the world for 2018, that tugged at my heart and made me feel proud of the place that I work, the place that gave birth to the Beano, amongst other cultural icons still relevant today. So yeah, that was good.
Don't forget, we have more than 70 episodes in our back catalogue archive thing. If you go to the website and look on the Discovery tab, you can find all our previous interviews. A bunch of people, Facebook, Twitter, The Times, Condé Nast, Bauer, all sorts of people.
And of course, we have a newsletter. If you haven't listened before, we have a newsletter. If you have listened before, we have a newsletter. So that's got what we're reading in our own words on this week's interview and all the stories we've talked about this week. It's got a quote of the week, it has charts, it's got a lot of stuff in it, so do sign up. And please, if you're already on the list and you like it, please forward it to somebody else. You know, we're only little and it's the only way we're going to grow is if you tell other people.
I'm only little.
As ever, thank you very much for listening to all our impressions and our roundups of media news and our interviews. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye-bye.